Good morning. It is April 9th. This is the Education Subcommittee for the Joint Ways and Means Full Committee. And we are here this morning, and we're going to do a public hearing on House Bill 5024. And what do we have for announcements?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to let you know that there's some responses to yesterday's questions from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I believe they're at your places in paper form. They'll also be posted to OLIS under yesterday's date. And we will likely be in a different room for Tuesday's public hearing. I think that's been your past practice, too, for public hearings, to go to a little bit bigger room.
And we've been in room C.
Yeah, we're investigating those opportunities right now, and we'll let you know probably on Monday. And that's it.
Thank you. And with that, I still want to call you Representative Cannon. Ben Cannon, the director of the executive director. I'm going to read the whole thing. Executive director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Good morning. And Brian Fox is with us again today. And he looks at all those budget things. So, gentlemen, are you ready down there?
For what?
To pay attention.
Oh, yeah. Now we are.
Good morning.
Good morning, Co-Chair Kump, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And we will be extremely brief in introducing the topic that you'll cover today. I expect to have holes bored in the back of my head by the eyes sort of peering at us from behind as they await their turn to present to you about the great work going on their campuses. Today we'll talk and introduce the subject of discussion having to do with state programs at our public universities. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian.
Today we'll be talking about the state program funding item. You may have noticed on some of the budget slides yesterday, the budget for universities split into two last biennium. Sort of one tranche that is really operation funds, the support fund, and then one tranche that is related to the public service mission of the institutions, the state programs. And so today we'll be talking about the state programs line. There has been some significant change within a major portion of the state programs, the Engineering Technology Industry Council. So you'll notice some significant reduction in the CSL budget for state programs, and that's related to the moving of ETIC out of state programs and over to the OEIB. And then this go around through POP 90, moving a significant portion of the sustaining funds from ETIC back into the HEC budget to flow through to the institutions.
So is this to confuse us or make GAD clarity?
No, absolutely to confuse you.
Because it's like, okay, juggling, okay.
So welcome to my life.
Should they say what ETIC is so that the
people listening on TV? Well, ETIC would be helpful, and he said about three acronyms there in one sentence.
I used that $30.
I was just hoping that those people listening.
Only if you got your tax returns. Mr. Siebert, did you have any clarification for that? Okay.
ETIC is the Engineering Technology Industry Council, which is an industry partnership that has focused on the engineering technology and sort of advanced economy in Oregon. They've made significant investments since the mid-90s or late 90s in the engineering departments in particular at all seven institutions. If we move to the next slide, the state programs are operated largely by the three public research universities. They're focused on economic development, industry partnerships, public service needs of Oregon. These really, if you can think about universities as a three-legged stool, one of those being much of what you heard yesterday around students, education, the transmission of knowledge. Another leg of that stool is the research mission of institutions, the development and advancement of knowledge. And then that third leg is public service. It's meeting the needs of the community, meeting the needs of the state, meeting the needs of the nation and the world. The state programs line is really about meeting the needs of the state, the nation, and the world. These line items are legislatively appropriated, and support has extended key capacities of the institutions over time. And these programs range significantly in scope from mediation and conflict resolution to demographic forecasting and maritime research. This really runs the gamut of our institutions' capacities and capabilities. There's another portion that isn't included within the state programs that is still embedded within the support fund. And those are really sort of mission-directed items that run the gamut, again, from the Southwestern Oregon Community University Center to research supports, over $10 million a biennium, that, again, largely focused at the research institutions, to nursing collaborative that's funded between OHSU and the regional and technical universities, regional solutions, campus public services, ranging from the Bach Festival at the University of Oregon, JPR at Southern Oregon, among many others. So there are, though there is a portion, a distinct fund that services public services, there's also another part within the support fund that services or provides resources for our institutions. With that, if we move to the next slide, this is really a list of items, and I won't go into depth here. The institutions have their stakeholders that are available to speak to many of these. And if you go to the next slide, I do, we spoke about the ETIC reconfiguration, and I just want to note it real quickly because it is a major portion of these funds and it's a significant change. ETIC had been housed within the Chancellor's office, and those dollars went to institutions. They've really served as bedrock support, built many of the, or in some ways built and added to the research capacity, the student capacity, the teaching capacity at the at each of the institutions, largely focused on the engineering programs. These funds, the Engineering Technology Industry Council, and you'll hear from a member of that council later today, went through a revisioning process to and decided that it was important to split those funds, part to sustain the advances that had been made, and part to more nimbly focus on industry needs. Those funds, the sustaining funds, will move over under POP 90 to the OEIB, to the HEC, will be distributed out to the institutions. Those more nimble, renewable funds will flow through the OEIB and in agreement with the Employment Department to focus on industry needs, to focus on sort of more short-term, tactical talent development focus. Many of you have probably heard about House Bill 2728, the Oregon Talent Council. Those funds are tied up in that process. And that's all that I'll speak to there. And I think at this point we can turn it over, hopefully in under 5 minutes, to our industry partnerships.
Okay. Or our industry. Thank you. And before this panel leaves, Mr. McGee, did you have any comments or anything?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to switch. And Mr. Adams and Ms. Singer, Ben, you introduce who's coming up. I've got a whole list here.
I think Brian has the list.
Yeah, first up will be Ron Adams, the Vice President for Research at Oregon State.
And are we going to follow this list as presented? Okay.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Chair Comp and Chair Monroe, for the record, I'm Ron Adams. I'm the Vice President for Research on an interim basis at Oregon State University. Previous to this stint, I was Dean of Engineering at OSU for 13 years and very familiar with the ETIC program. Prior to that, I was at Tektronix for 14 years and involved in commercialization of technology. So that's a background that I think helps with what we're going to be speaking about today. And what I'd like to do is begin with the public service aspects of what we're going to present, and then we'll move to just a high-level overview of our research programs at the major universities, and then into commercialization, and finally finish with workforce development. So with that in mind, I'd like Laura Singer and Jack Barth to come forward and begin their presentations on their public service projects.
And it's Dr. Adams, isn't it?
Dr. Adams, correct.
Yeah. Do you have a slide presentation going with this?
Yes, there will be. And
I'm going to have Mr. Siebert help us find where it's at then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the presentation they're going to be walking through is under today's date.
Thank you.
And you'll have to bear with me while I try to, well, somebody's going to help me. Okay.
That's the way we work here, too.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Laurel Singer. I'm the director of Oregon Solutions and Oregon Consensus. Co-chair Comp, co-chair Monroe, and committee members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here and present to you information about the state programs that you've been supporting and give you a little picture about what those are about. If you'll handle the slides for me. The universities have many programs that serve Oregonians outside the classroom. And as you can see, they have very similar names, and they're often very confusing. So what I want to emphasize is that today I'm really going to be talking about the state programs, the top tier. But as Brian mentioned, there's also the campus public service programs, and those are unique to each institute and part of the public service mission. And then you also have, not to be confused, with the statewide public service programs. And as you can see, these are the three distinct programs, and you'll be getting a presentation from those programs next Monday. So I won't be covering those as well. So as Brian mentioned, I just want to emphasize how, remind you of how the state program's appropriation category came into existence. In 2013, the legislature separated the education and general appropriations into two categories. One was the public university support fund that goes to direct operational support for students and institutes. And then you have the public university state programs. That's us. Institutions, centers, and programs that address economic development, natural resources, and other issues that provide public service across the state. And all seven universities share a public service mission and participate in one or more of these state programs. So before I delve into the state programs, again, I want to give a nod to these campus-based programs, the public service programs that engage Oregonians. And here's a list of them. Brian mentioned a few of them. And again, I want to just acknowledge that these are supported by that first category of funding for operational. And they're in line with the university's missions, unique missions in public service. And some of these should be very familiar to you. So now I want to jump in and just give you a picture about what some of these state programs do and the benefits that they give to Oregonians across the state and in community. And I'm going to be talking about two programs in particular. One is Oregon Solutions, and the other is the dispute resolution programs that operate out of University of Oregon and Portland State. And then I'm going to turn it over to Jack Barth to talk about the exciting program, the Ocean-Going Research Vessel, through the Oregon State University. So that's our game plan moving forward. So I want to talk about Oregon Solutions. This program was established at Portland State University in the College of Urban and Public Affairs in 2002. Oregon Solutions is designed to implement sustainable solutions to community-based problems through bringing representatives of multi-sectors and entities together to integrate their resources and work together and collaborate in order to make something happen, to solve a problem or address an opportunity in their community. What people often talk about Oregon Solutions is the modern-day version of a barn raising, where the community pulls together in order to really help each other and lift themselves up. So I just to walk you through how this happens piece by piece in this model. So oftentimes a community member, community entity or a leader will say, we've got to do something about this problem, or we've got a real opportunity here we don't want to let go of. And they will contact us and say, you know, we think this might be an Oregon Solution issue or something you could really help us with. And our team will go out and really begin to scope up, what do you want to achieve here? What are your objectives? What are the outcomes that you want? Who do you need? And can we get those people to the table? Are they willing to? And most importantly, who are some of the leaders who might be willing to serve as our conveners or champions to really carry the water and really form the group as it moves forward? When all those pieces are in place, we'll go to the governor and we'll ask the governor to designate it as an Oregon Solution project. That designation means a lot. It elevates the importance of it, and it serves as a magnet to bring other resources to the table because of that prominence. Once it's designated, we'll then work with the conveners to pull together their team, to collaborate and work together, to leverage their funding and align their resources in order to get something done. So that's sort of the model. And let me give you some examples of those. I have to say, I think the biggest challenge for me in this presentation was to really pick which one of our children that I want you to see, because they're all special to us, and we've got about 75 projects now under our belt. But I decided it'd be easier to categorize them. I think there's those Oregon Solution projects that leverage resources that build critical infrastructure. These are what we think of as our bricks and mortar projects. And one of our flagship projects that really illustrates that is the Vernonia Schools project. In 2007, out in Columbia County, they had 11 inches of rain in 24 hours that created massive floodings and significant and irreparable damage to their school, to their schools that were located in the floodplain. Oregon Solutions was called in, and we worked with two great conveners, as you can see, Tony Hyde, who was the county commissioner, and Tom Kelly, who was the president of Neil Kelly Remodelers. We had a team of about 30 people who represented all different segments of government. They had industry representatives. We had school district representatives. We had community empathy entities and philanthropic entities that all came together to say, first of all, where do we want to relocate? Let's find some higher ground. And then how is it that we build a plan for a state-of-the-art school campus? And that's what they did together. They raised $13 million in a local bond, federal money, and state dollars that actually now, as those schools are functioning and operating and really serving as a cornerstone of their community. So that's an example of the bricks and mortar type projects, and you can see a few other examples. The other category of projects were Oregon Solution projects that foster economic development and technical innovation. And some of those projects, again, which child do I want to highlight here? I guess I'm going to start with the RAIN project. And this is where you had two mayors, one from Eugene and one from Corvallis, who really saw an opportunity to create a business accelerator for generating, and specifically in the technology industry. And they pooled their resources, they united business, community entities, the universities played a prominent role, different layers of government representatives, and they have created an accelerator to really foster these technological businesses that are bringing in new revenue into the South Willamette Valley, as well as spawning new jobs for the community. So again, this is an example of that category. And then finally, we have those kind of Oregon Solution projects that support what I think of as Oregon's most precious resources of both human and natural resources. And these are examples of these different projects. And one of the projects I want to emphasize is the Klamath Tribe's Chiloquin community. And this community really wanted to come together to think about how can they take the long view on addressing poverty. And they decided that it started with early learning. And they're forming a team that is bringing together parents with community services in order to really look at how they can make sure children are ready to read by the time they get to kindergarten. And one of the things that they're just in process, they're looking at a mobile book service as well as an innovative strategy that involves text messaging parents individually to say, did you read to your children tonight? So they, all of our projects culminate in what we call a declaration of cooperation. And this is actually a formalized document where everybody says, this is what I'm going to commit to in order to make this happen. And they have the Declaration of Cooperation signings. They're big events. Oftentimes the governor herself may show up. And the community turns out to really celebrate what they've accomplished together. And this DOC will happen in late spring, so if you get a chance, I'd like to really invite you all down there. It's really a heartwarming event. So that's a look at some of the categories of the projects. These are project-based, they implement, they create solutions. And now I want to shift to the dispute resolution programs. I'll briefly cover that, and hopefully if there's any questions, I can get to those. So the dispute resolution programs came over to the universities from the Dispute Resolution Commission in around 2003. And they split those programs into two prongs. One is the Oregon Office for Community Dispute Resolution that operates in the law school out of University of Oregon. And that program administers and funds about 20 community-based mediation centers across the state operating in about 25 counties. And these are programs that work on community-based conflict resolution. These are neighbor-to-neighbor issues. These are small claims kind of issues, landlord-tenant. And they're also, they pioneered the foreclosure mediation programs. So together, they are volunteer-driven. They integrate about 900 volunteers across our state who implement those mediation services. And if you take them collectively in any one year, they resolve about 6,500 conflict cases in our communities. So very impressive. I just want to give you a picture of what some of those cases might look like. And this came from one of our centers, an actual case, where a man owed an elderly landlord about 3 months of back rent. And so before she filed eviction proceedings, she agreed that she'd try mediation. So they came together with a neutral third party to look at the situation. And the tenant in the process of mediation revealed that he had lost his job as a logger, and also revealed that he was struggling because he had a very strong work ethic and keeping his commitments was important to him. Also in the context, the landlord revealed that she used a wood fire to wood stove to heat her house. So together in that session, they decided that he would pay the back rent by providing 3 cords of lumber for her. And together they healed that relationship and continued to work together. So again, it's an example of how that case would have come to court. And you think about those 6,500 cases that would have been burdening the already overburdened court systems. So they also integrate a lot of student volunteers, so teaching youth the conflict resolution skills that are really building problem solving from the ground up. So that's that program that operates out of the University of Oregon. And then my program operates out of Portland State University in the College of Urban Studies and Planning Affairs. And our program is focused more on public policy, dispute resolution, and agreement seeking around public issues. So we have, since 2005, probably done 300 public cases across the state, probably in every corner. And again, our program focuses on resolving differences and seeking agreement. So if you want to move forward. So again, there's two categories I want to focus on. One is that we work on statewide initiatives. So we'll work with a state agency on rolling out some of their key initiatives across the state. So for example, we've worked very closely with the Early Learning Division on the rollout of the Early Learning Hubs. As you might imagine, integrating all those services and realignment doesn't always go smoothly. So we've really been there as a support to those communities to work together and try to reach agreements on some critical issues about how they're going to govern together, how they're going to deliver services. We've been very integral to some of the unification efforts that are going on in Marion County, with Polk County, again in the Four Rivers area, and down in Klamath and Lake County. So we've really been there as a neutral provider to help those counties in that complex work that they're trying to do and move that work forward for the Early Learning Division. At the same time, we'll also do some work on statewide issues like population forecasting. I won't get down in the weeds on this, but I will say that population forecasting drives a lot of planning and a lot of development in the state. And there was a very complicated system that was cumbersome and holding up some of that work. So we worked with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Association of Counties, and the League of Oregon Cities to pull together a stakeholder effort to look at, can we do this differently? They put forth legislation that flew through with almost unanimous support to revise how that's calculated and how that population forecasting is done in the state, and will save the state millions of dollars over the next decades and move projects along at a much quicker rate. I also just wanted to emphasize some of the, in addition to the statewide kinds of projects that we do, we also do local place-based issues. And these are just an example of some of the place-based communities where we'll come in and help them resolve some of the issues and the conflicts that they might have. So one of our ones that is going to be kicking off is over in Eastern Oregon. This is in response to some of those horrific fires that were devastating out there several years ago. We're helping them pull together a multi-stakeholder group to look at some unique ways that they might be able to prevent these fires moving forward, to develop some agreements and protocols around how the multiple volunteer and state and federal firefighting entities can really work together in a more coordinated effort and be more effective in fighting the fires, and then how they can really work to rehab and restore those areas once those fires have occurred. So that's just a glimpse of some of the work that these statewide programs are doing across the state. And with that, if there's any questions before I turn it over to Jack.
Any questions for Dr. Singer?
Not yet. I'm in the process, but not there yet. Just
Laura.
I'm close.
Yeah,
almost.
Some of us are in that spot, yes. But thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Great presentation.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Jack Barth. I'm a professor of oceanography in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. I also wear the hat of Associate Dean for Research. So I just wanted to share with you about this great program that Oregon is investing in its understanding and how we keep track of what's going on in the ocean. Oregon really is an ocean state. I'll just say that every second breath you take is due to the plankton putting oxygen into the atmosphere. The rivers connect us from the ocean up into the inland waterways. The weather. Who noticed that this winter was different, right?
The ocean
was 4 degrees C, about 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer over the past 8 months due to changes in the North Pacific. Well, how do we know all this? We have to get an ocean vessel out to sea and pay attention to what's going on, and that's the intent of this bill. So other issues that we're keeping track of are changes in the ocean chemistry. You may have heard about ocean acidification. This is where the excess CO2 in the atmosphere is going into the ocean, changing the pH, and that's ultimately affecting, for example, the oyster hatcheries. And so these kinds of vessels, Oregon's investment in paying attention to what's going on in the ocean is very valuable. The other benefit is it gets students out to sea. So we want to get them off the web, and we want to get them out making actual measurements. And that's the legacy that's going to go forward. Those measurements will be available as we try to figure out what's changing. So I just want to share with you how this came about and what we're doing with it. There's a research vessel council that we run a competitive program for proposals throughout the state to take the vessel out for a number of days. And what you can see from this list is it's a very wide-ranging group. We have University of Oregon represented on there. We've got the North Coast with Clatsop Community College. We've got each of the agencies. So as we talk about these issues about sustainable seafood or shipping and weather modification, each of those folks is at the table. And I should say we look forward to talking with you in November, where we give a more formal report. We funded three proposals. These are to get the ocean-going vessel. This is a 175-foot research vessel, Oceanus. And as we speak today, it's offshore installing part of the buoy system that from the National Science Foundation. It's the largest civilian investment in oceanography in history. And OSU in Oregon is very much part of that. We're going to have some eyes out there watching these issues I'm talking about. This one proposal is to take students out and to teach them the techniques and go to an area where we place one of our marine reserves. So these are no-take areas that are meant to retain the biodiversity and the health of our ocean. But we need to know what's the baseline and how are things changing because of that policy that we implemented. So Angel White took out a group of students, and it was a terrific experience. More recently, and you can look at that March date right there, this was just a few weeks ago, Dr. Chris Goldfinger led a group that went offshore and looked at the ocean bottom. And we want to know something about it because of the wave energy installations that are likely to happen out there. Is it amenable to the anchoring and the installation that we're going to do? So he took a group out, looked off both Camp Rylea and Newport at those areas. And those will form the foundation for each of our industry partners, wave energy, Oregon Iron Works, et cetera, that are involved in this kind of business adventure.
Excuse me, Doctor. When they're out there, are they looking at the fault lines and potential earthquake documentation also?
This particular one is in state waters, so it's about out to about 150 feet depth.
Okay.
If you go further out on the shelf and drop down to what we call the subduction zone, that's where the Cascadia faults are. And it just so happens that Chris Goldfinger, Dr. Chris Goldfinger, is probably the world's experts on that. So I guarantee you he thought to slip out there and probably take a few measurements.
Make sure there was fuel enough in the tanks. Okay.
So this is really at the heart of getting the students out there and training that next generation. And it really meant to reach up and down the coast, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level. So Dr. Rob Wheatcroft took a group out over spring break, and they went offshore of the Florence and Umpqua River area. A lot of sediments going out. It's being deposited offshore. It makes its way back onto our sandy shores, either helps fortify them or we have erosion processes, and we're understanding how that sediment moves back and forth. So again, just a couple weeks ago. I'll go back to that first trip in April, and this was really an oceanography boot camp. And you can see that we had students from OSU, U of O, from Clatsop. They were out for 4 days, and they got to learn how to actually get the work done. And they returned with this respect for what it takes to do that. It's pretty easy to jump on the web and find a data set and work on that, but getting out there, making high-quality measurements in the rolling seas is a different challenge. So this is just a quote from Molly O'Neill about how she learned to be part of the team. She learned how to safely work aboard a vessel and really how to carry out this research that the state is invested in by allowing us to go out on the ocean-going research vessel. So I'd just like to ask Coach Aircomp, Coach R. Monroe members, if you have any other questions about the ocean-going research vessel program.
Yes, Senator Roblin, are you going to ask how many pictures were in your district?
Oh, all of those were. Well, at Camarillo it wasn't. Okay. Most of those were. But, no, I was going to say Oregon City is also, it's not exactly a part of this project, but they are designing the next group of ocean-going vessels, research vessels for the U.S., and they're in the process of design. We're hoping that we will be able to get one of those newest versions. That's not part of the design. We have to go after that separately, but we are excited about the fact that they were the selected university to do the work for the National Marine Services in developing these new, the next generation of ocean-going ships for research.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. And as somebody that loves being at the beach, and I have 4 daughters and a number of grandchildren, I just appreciate the work that the universities are doing to keep our atmosphere, our air clean. It's so important, and it's appreciated. Senator Roblin,
the other thing about
Representative
this project,
Taylor.
Oh, and thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing that's nice about this research, last session and the session before, we actually bought for the state of Oregon part of the time of the ship. So we had our people who had questions about the ocean buy time and do the research that they needed to do. We've got marine reserves. We've got a whole bunch of other issues that are out there in our nearshore. And we don't own a ship as a state, but we do have the opportunity to buy time on these research vessels. And I think that's another part of why we need to keep this stuff there.
Yeah, why the collaboration is so important.
Yep.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. Since I have you here, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, because this winter was so unseasonably warm, which concerns me greatly, most likely, I think, due to climate change, perhaps, does this mean it will be this warm next year, maybe? I don't really want that, but is this a one-off thing, or is this going to, you anticipate this to be warming? And I don't know if you can answer that. But.
Yeah. Co-Chair Com, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Taylor. We've been able to link this warming, which is really phenomenal, to changes in further out in the Gulf of Alaska, where there was less of this mixing from the winds. So the water just stayed warmer at the surface.
Mm-hmm.
It then came to our shores, warms up the atmosphere, and it goes all across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
These kinds of things happen in 10-year cycles, It is, I can tell you right now, it's not El Nino. It's mm-hmm. not this once every few mm-hmm. years mm-hmm. things. That, so we think it's more of a decadal pattern that has to switch. And we cannot predict when that switch is going to happen. But I do think there's a kind of a memory that goes a year or two or three at a time.
Hmm. Wasn't this warm 10 years ago, but okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Well, and along that sequence of questions, because our Pacific Ocean has generally been much colder than the Atlantic Ocean, it's like, well, should we go and actually try to put our feet in the water here in Oregon, or just still freeze when we do that? So it's always very cold.
Thank you for that, Representative.
Yes.
Just a quick opportunity, because the best time to put your feet in the ocean is actually oftentimes in the winter.
Right.
Because our coldest water comes to us in the summer. And a lot of people don't really understand the upwelling that happens at the coast. So I don't know if he wants to say a statement about that or not with respect to helping you. And those of us that do polar bear on the Oregon coast, we understand that. And so we'll go jump in the ocean in the middle of the winter, and it's oftentimes better than if I'd done that in the middle of summer. So.
Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, Senator Roblin is exactly right. And that's one of the little secrets, is there's 2 or 3 weeks in February that are probably the best time out at the Oregon coast.
There we go. Well, thank you. And for some of us that have great-grandchildren and grandchildren, now we know. So.
But I just wanted to tie up the short session here by thanking you again for your support for this whole variety of programs. And also just to remind us how they give advantages to our state. They, as we said, there's community engagement. They're inspiring to our students and faculty. They provide better chances for students to get into the higher education, to stick with it, this experiential learning, the involvement in consensus building. All that helps them graduate better. And then finally, the impact on our communities, both getting students out into the communities, getting jobs, making a real impact. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your dedication. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Adams.
Dr. Adams.
Thank you. Next, we're going to shift gears just a little bit, and I'm going to seek some help again with the technology and get the slides up. And I'd like to have Vince Porter and Andrew Watson to come forward. And what we're going to do is we're going to be speaking to you about research and innovation and how that impacts economic development. And I think you're going to find that there's also a common thread around talent development that will be part of the last part of the morning is really focused on that.
Well, and I was going to say, and I will mention, Dr. Adams, that Ben Cannon showed us the numbers of students and the student growth in the university. So I know that that complements part of what you're dealing with here.
Right, and just like what you heard earlier, the research enterprise provides a great learning opportunity for the students, not only those engaged directly as graduate students, but also undergraduates. And the stories about the time at sea that you heard earlier are examples of that. So to get started with this, it's just really, here's my introduction here. Just a little bit about the process of innovation, and this is a pretty standard process where, you know, we do research. Out of that often comes inventions, and some of those inventions have value, so we find pathways to commercialize those inventions and then have not only a commercial value but also economic impact and job creation. The source of, we'll say the capital source of invention is really represented in the research enterprise of the four major universities. And as you can see here, there's an excess of $800 million annually invested in R&D in those universities. The majority of those funds are from the federal government, and there is a growing component from the private sector also.
And I'm going to kind of walk through each of those universities and give you just some quick highlights, beginning with Oregon Health and Sciences University. As you can see, in excess of $350 million program. And this is really Oregon's academic health center. And the research enterprise there, of course, is focused on that. And a lot of opportunity for interdisciplinary research and also collaboration with the other institutions in the system. And you're all familiar with the Knight Challenge, and OHSU has done a remarkable job with that, responding well and very close to meeting the challenge, as you can see from the numbers here. Oregon State University's enterprise, again, is about $285 million. And what the faculty do is really focus on some of the major global challenges that that we all face. You heard about the ocean earlier. In fact, we have a marine studies initiative that is really focused on ocean and coastal health. We also are involved in safe and secure food and water through our Ag Sciences program, as well as some of the other programs across the university. And sustainability is important to us. You've probably heard about our efforts in wood structures, especially tall buildings, is really related to that that area. And as you heard earlier, the whole area of health and prevention is an opportunity for collaboration with OHSU, and then climate change. And we had a long conversation about climate change earlier. This is an example of one of our projects, basically the Andrews Experimental Forest. And what you see here is really a snapshot of time. Actually, this forest has been an experimental forest has been in operation since the 50s, so it truly is a long-term enterprise. And we just got a continuation of that effort through a grant from the National Science Foundation. This would be the sixth time that we've received a five-year continuation. And this is really about the interplay between what we do as citizens and what the environment does, and then what the consequence of that is in terms of the ecosystem. The University of Oregon is about $110 million enterprise. As you can see, it's growing substantially. A lot of the efforts at OSU relate to some of our signature research centers, including ONAMI, especially in material science. This is an example of one of their programs, and it relates to the impact of climate change on the pine beetle epidemic in the central and eastern part of the state. This is basically some computational modeling that's funded by the National Science Foundation. And one of the things that the legislature helped with is the renovation of the library and also some expansion that was really important to the university, especially in creating an opportunity for data visualization capability. And all of our universities today are heavily involved in lots of big data analytics, and visualization of that is extremely important. And then the other thing going on here, and you'd mentioned about the growth of the universities and student body, and there's no exception at U of O, especially in science, where you see the 72% growth. So this facility is really going to help address the needs of the students as well. Portland State University is roughly a $64 million portfolio. A lot of the research there is focused on urban communities, and also transportation and sustainability are important there. And there are some important partnerships both in the region as well as beyond. And we and PSU have partnerships in water, for example, that water research that are important.
Dr. Adams, I have to ask a question because I have been at PSU as a graduate student and doctoral student, and I keep talking to them about the education center. Have they decided, because the business center is getting renovated and they're kicking out the education department. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
Okay.
If you would like a response to that question, I think we can get back to you on it. But
well, Vim promised that he had it taken care of, and so I'm waiting for somebody to show me what that might look like. So you're okay.
Okay.
I'm just picking on him today.
So okay.
You can pass the word.
Okay, and this is an example of one of the grants that PSU recently received. This, of course, is one of the largest grants that they've received in history, the $24 million. And the powerful thing about this is it's really about bringing unrepresented students into occupations around health and the biomedical behavior, clinical and social science disciplines, which is kind of a way to integrate those capabilities into their community. And now we're going to shift gears here and look at, well, so you saw a little bit about the research portfolio. Again, it creates great experiences for student learnings and then also discovery. And what Andrew is going to speak about is how some of those discoveries are being translated through commercialization to economic impact.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrew Watson, Director of Technology Transfer at Oregon Health and Science University. I've been director there for a little over 3 years. I've been at OHSU for a little over 8. I've been in technology commercialization out of the university system for about 15 years at a variety of places across the country. So I'm going to talk about how the research that goes on at the universities here in the state of Oregon are translated into businesses, translated into products and services that help all of us in the public community. I'm from Oregon Health and Science University. We're not one of the public universities here, but we are a public corporation. We're a little different, but I'm here to represent the collaborative nature of all the universities here in the state. Oops.
And Dr. Robinson hasn't made any promises to me, so.
Okay. So I want to first begin, and I'm not going to go through a lot of details on these slides. This is a standard process that the major universities, research universities in the state undergo, from taking early stage university ideas or discoveries to the commercial marketplace. And this is an example of the processes that go on within the university settings with outside business entrepreneurs to launch hopefully profitable companies in the state of Oregon here. Many of the universities have similar programs where they have business students engaged, entrepreneurship classes, entrepreneurs and residents who are experts from the local business communities that can help move these technologies along. But with all basic research out of the university, most of our funding is from the government agencies, as Dr. Adams indicated. But that declines when research reaches the stage of development into a product or service. This is often referred to as the Valley of Death, where there's a lack of funding in this area. This area has continued to grow as traditional venture capital looks for later-term technology, de-risk technology, in order to move it into the private sector. So, some of the things we're trying to do at the university systems is fill that valley of death, and I'll talk about some of the state programs that are helping in that area. But I want to go through what is happening at some of the universities. Okay. So, on the bottom left here is a actual real life example of a commercialization project at Oregon Health and Science University, where the original idea early stage technology came to us in 2008. There was patents filed by us. We were able to invest in it through the Bioscience Innovation Program that we have, which is funded by the state tax credit program, which is through the University Venture Development Fund, or UVDF. There was other follow-on funding, such as federal SBIR and Phase 1 and Phase 2 grants, and we're looking for this product to hopefully be on the market and for sale sometime this year. So it is a long-term process. This project took 7-plus years to get to the market. But what we're doing in the universities is starting to be picked up by the business community. A recent article out of the Portland Business Journal in January this year highlights what's happening as an outcome from the universities. You know, collectively, this report indicates that there are 50-plus companies that have been spun out of the universities and helping to grow the economy here locally in the state. So one of the funds that is helping to bridge some of that valley of death that I talked about is the University Venture Development Fund. This is a tax credit program here in the state. We are currently attempting to have it renewed. It's up to have it extended currently, but it provides some of that early proof of concept funding in the blue column there, to take those early university ideas, invest in them, prove what market that technology may be good for. Then it can lead into scale up funding from the signature research centers in the state, and then follow on to commercialization with either a new company being formed or licensing to an existing company. The key thing with this is it's a tax credit program that actually pays back to the state. It has a payback mechanism of 20% of revenue derived from the investments are paid back to the state to pay back those tax credits. So the other mechanism that's helping to fill that gap are the signature research centers in the state that have been funded by state funds. So that's ONAMI, which is focused on micro nanotechnology. OTRADI, which is focused more on biotechnology, and then Oregon Best, which is focused on clean and green technology. All of these signature research centers have programs where they help to fund and de-risk early-stage technologies coming out of the university systems to help primarily help grow companies here in the state. The other aspect that's been helping, and some of these are actually fairly new in the last year or two, are the business accelerators that have been established in the state. So it's been mentioned a couple times this morning about the RAIN, the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network, down in Corvallis and Eugene. There's Sustainable Valley Technology Group down in the Southern Oregon area. The Portland State Business Accelerator has been in existence for a number of years and has roughly 20 or 30 companies there that have incubated in those companies in that space and grown. In the last 2 years, the first bioscience-focused incubator has been created out of OTRADI, which is the OTRADI Bioscience Incubator based in Portland. Currently, they're expanding their space to accommodate, I believe, nine or ten companies now in that space. And then there's Bend Accelerator out in Bend area that actually helps a number of industries and companies that are popping up out in eastern Oregon. So I'm going to go through a few of the highlights from some of the universities in terms of moving early stage technology down the development pipeline into commercial products and services. So University of Oregon, these are some of their highlights from last year, where their startups had created 275 jobs. They had $7.1 million in licensing revenue. You know, their companies brought in $27 million and 22 startups cumulatively over the last few years. Similar things are happening at Oregon State University and Oregon Health and Science University, as well as PSU. We collectively are starting a number of companies here that are staying local and contributing to the local economy. So their license income, what do we do with this license income when it comes in? Well, it actually is put back into research within the university system. So it's a circular process where we bring in licensing income and we reinvest that back into the pipeline. So University of Oregon, if you divide their licensing income based on their research expenditures, it's about 9.2%, which puts them at one of the most highly performing institutions in the country. So some of the success stories that have been coming out of the universities, one is Honeycomb, which is it's part of Oregon's growing unmanned aerial systems industry. It's primarily going to be used for agricultural uses. It has targeted application of pesticides, fertilizers. It's a partnership between multiple institutions here in the state, Portland State University, OSU, and the Extension. It's actually based in Wilsonville, and it's created. It currently has 15 employees. Another success story is a company named Rexigen. This was one of the six startup companies launched out of Oregon Health and Science University in 2003. Its primary technology is a new weight management drug called Contrave. The company raised about $255 million in 2007, and just last fall, it received FDA approval and marketing began with sales happening here in the United States. And just last month, it received European approval. Finally, another success story out of Oregon State University was a 2007 spin-out, NuScale Power. It's developing safer and more reliable nuclear power generation. It's really a game changer for small modular reactive technology. It received a very substantial Department of Energy grant, $226 million, and currently it's created 600 jobs.
Could you tell us a little bit more about this program?
Co-Chair Comp, I probably defer to Dr. Adams from Oregon State University, who might know more about that.
Yeah, are you curious about the technology, the application, or
that here we have another potential coming out of Oregon to generate the energy for the future?
Right. Yeah, especially the base power generation is what this would address. Basically, it's an invention that came out of the nuclear engineering department at Oregon State University. It is designed to be predominantly a passive device. It's not using very many pumps and valves, and that leads to higher reliability. And it's makes it safer. The modules are roughly in the 50 megawatt range, which, you know, on the scale of what that means is that one module would power the city of Corvallis. The way this would likely...
That's very helpful, because I'm thinking, is this something that would fit in my, utility room? No.
Not exactly. This is more like it would fit on a rail car.
Okay, thank you.
And then the application that the company has identified is that is to number it up. So you'd use multiple modules to replace what might be a more conventional approach to power generation. The other thing about this is because it is a relatively small module, is amenable to a manufacturing process as opposed to a site-built process, again leading to higher safety and reliability.
So, thank you.
Follow?
Yes, Rep. Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. I'm just curious, 600 jobs, are those ongoing, or is that just to get to build it?
It's ongoing, and actually the number of jobs is increasing. The company intends to, once they get through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission approvals, they intend to make and sell this product, and they're projecting it's early 2022-23 time frame when that would happen. The company has a strategic partnership with Fluor. Mm-hmm. And And most of the employees are in Oregon. Some of those employees are based elsewhere. But no, we've been tracking this, as you can imagine, very closely. Mm-hmm. And they've just had a steady growth in employment since 2007.
Okay, thank you.
And one last question. Are they potentially looking at international trade on this?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They won't sell them in here.
So.
Yeah. Well,
that's right.
Sadly enough,
I just want to make sure.
Well, one of these may power your lights someday, but maybe not in Oregon. And that may not be placed in Oregon, but it may be placed somewhere.
Probably won't be in my lifetime.
Senator.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Manager. But military, I think, is also interested because they're trying to get to zero carbon emissions in their plant bases. And I have always wondered if our exempts the federal government, if they had a base in our state, could they use it? So I don't know the answer to that question. So. But I know that they've been interested. They've had conversations with Oregon State.
Well, considering a couple of years ago they wanted to take away our four F-14s, it's like, federal government, who knows?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Huffman.
I'll try to transition us off of this.
Okay.
Radioactive topic. So on a broader scale, something I bring up probably every biennium is my strong desire to make sure, whether it's the Oregon Inc. initiatives or all of our research and development at the universities, to make sure that we are maximizing our licensing capabilities and that we have clawbacks if we help fund and incubate a project or a company in Oregon and we lose them because venture capital comes in from New York or California and they suck the company out of Oregon because we put $16 million or so per biennium in Oregon Inc. initiatives and we, do quite a bit with university initiatives. So, I mean, it's just always been a passion of mine to make sure that I get the message out there that it's very important through licensing and whatever that we get that return. Mm-hmm. The, as you mentioned, the revolving fund portion, the 9.2% at OHSU and whatnot. But I think the universities have a better grasp on that than maybe some of the Oregon Inc. initiatives. And because talking to Tim McCabe when he was director of Business Oregon, it didn't seem that we were quite as successful through the Oregon Inc. initiatives as we have been through the universities. And I would like to see that change and evolve into a real cash flow center for the state.
Okay. Thank you. And I was going to say we are within about 20, 23 minutes of finishing up our time limit for today. So as we move forward, let's keep doing it.
Okay. And then we're going to now move to Vince Porter.
Okay, Vince,
it
away.
Co-Chair Compa, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Vince Porter. I'm the Jobs and Economy Policy Advisor for Governor Brown. I don't think I'll start by addressing, but I will get back to your comment, Representative Huffman, because I think it's very important. With Business Oregon and Sean Robbins, hopefully he's come around to meet most of you and talked about some of their new approaches to how they're looking at economic development. But and he's sworn to me that this was all before Measure 91, but his Grow Our Own approach to economic development is really driving how they're looking at how they're going to implement their own action plan. And a key element of that is establishing the first Innovation and Entrepreneurship Division within Business Oregon. And he just recently announced his hire of Heather Stafford from, we stole her from the Sustainable Valley Technology Group Accelerator, and also bring in our first entrepreneur in residence. I can remember his first name, Conth, but I cannot today remember his last name, so I apologize. But the intention there is to really, build on a key metric, which is, you know, we believe that 70% of all of the future job creation will come from companies from within the state. And while we're not going to ignore business recruitment, business creation and business retention is going to be a key element to how we move forward on economic development. So why that link is to this hearing is, you know, making sure that our research and our and the commercialization coming out of our universities is translating into local business, homegrown business creation is going to be a key factor and a key metric on whether or not he's successful or we're successful in that approach. And I think we're making a lot of headway. You know, what was refreshing, I've been in the job for about a year now, and the work there is that the collaboration exists. I don't know if we always do the best job of talking about the collaboration or demonstrating what happens between the universities and the research and an agency like Business Oregon, but it has existed. I think now we're just looking to beef it up and make it even stronger. Over the summer, we've had a lot of good conversations with Dr. Adams and other of the research VPs, just how we can build that and make it more intentional. And, you know, I was just going back to, I didn't bring any slides, but I was just going back to the slide that was earlier presented about this valley. And I think that's a really important thing that we got to be mindful of, is to make sure that that bridge, while it might sometimes be a fragile bridge or not one as strong as we want in the source of money, that it exists so that we don't lose those companies that are coming out with the good ideas and that we're helping them connect with our local business community. So I think over the next year, you're going to see a lot of that continue to move forward and continue to work with the universities, both through the signature research centers in Oregon, Inc., but also, you know, other aspects. I think I'm the third person to bring up RAIN, but I think that's been a very positive development in the Corvallis and Eugene area, not only with the companies that are coming out of the universities, but the fact that there are private sector companies that are working with the universities and working and integrating in a more meaningful way. And if, to the extent we can see more of that happen, we think that there'll be positive developments. One other piece I just would like to provide as an example of how we're trying to strengthen this is we just recently announced a small strategic reserve funding for an SBIR matching program. And this was intended to go and work with those companies that were earlier talked about that have received the small business innovation grants from the federal government to then give them some additional funding to help with commercialization. There was $400,000 that was put into that program, and in a matter of 3 weeks, they funded five applicants, and there were several more in the waiting. And we're really excited about just three of them were from Portland and two were from the Eugene area, just to see the results. If we can put relatively small amounts of money, and I think this is a key part about the local homegrown approach to economic development, is sometimes it does feel like a stretch, especially in the context of the university system, that these investments can be difficult in negotiating, but they often end up being far less expensive than what it takes to recruit a company from outside. So I just want to reemphasize that we're eager and excited about our opportunity to continue to further this collaboration. I think the more also to Representative Huffman's point about making sure that they don't leave the state, I think there are two elements to that, making sure that the communities, not only that they don't leave the state, but I think one goal we would like to have is that they don't even leave the community where they originate, so that the goal of success is not to necessarily move a Eugene product or idea up to Portland, but that we can actually have other parts of the state continuing with their own innovation hubs. But also working and having that strong conversation between the business community so that the research universities can understand what the needs are for our companies locally and that the ecosystem is driving the decisions about which products we ought to be or which technologies we ought to be commercializing because the resources are here to help cultivate them. Now I'll just leave that, my comments at that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and we're open to any questions if you have any additional questions.
Well, I think we'll move on, Dr. Adams, because okay. The clock's ticking.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. What we're going to do, you heard a lot about research and innovation. Really, it creates a great environment for learning and talent development. So the next topic is about talent. And Dr. Chris Maples from OIT, president of OIT, and Mr. Dave Childers will come forward and speak to that topic.
And if possible, if we could get finished in about 10 minutes so we can get to our 10 o'clock meetings on time. If that only gives you about 5 minutes apiece, I apologize, but I know you guys can do it.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe Committee, thank you very much. We will finish on time, and just before I start, Co-chair Comp, I don't have any promises to you. I've forgotten, do I?
No, I know. You have fulfilled all your promises.
Okay, we're good.
You've right up to, you know, Klamath Falls to Wilsonville. So
you've heard a lot about the local innovations and about technology development, about science development, about how students have benefited from university research and industry-supported projects.
Your name, just Dr. Maples.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Chris Maples. I'm president of Oregon Institute of Technology.
Thank you.
My apologies. I was trying to get to that 5 minutes. This really is a two-way street. There are new ideas that are generated at the universities, and there are graduates who really are much more ready for the real world, and we're starting to see that more and more. This is a crowd that's coming out of our universities and using, as you just heard, small amounts of money here and there locally to establish businesses. In fact, we have a catalyzed Klamath idea going now with small amounts of money, competitions to get businesses started in the Klamath Falls area, including one that has some real excitement. It's generated a fair amount of excitement in which a group is growing crops inside of a shipping container and using aeroponics basically to do that, and can grow up to 2 acres worth of crops inside of a standard shipping container. And these are the kinds of things, the kinds of ideas that are being stimulated. There have been great legislative investments in economic development and talent development, and the latter has been primarily through ETIC, the Engineering Technology Industry Council. ETIC has gone through a bit of a funding transition where the funding has been bifurcated into both sustaining funds and then new initiative funds. The ETIC goals with industry oversight really have leveraged private investment at a 2-to-1 ratio, and I think I need to hit the next slide here. Perfect. Or you can hit a line. I can hit a line here. We've basically doubled the undergraduate engineering enrollment. We have doubled the externally funded research and have increased the engineering master's degrees by 50% in Oregon. The HEC has been asked by ETIC to make these sustaining funds a priority. And by way of background, one of the things I used to do before I came to Oregon is I was a program director at the National Science Foundation for 3 years with a whole bunch of different programs, including authoring some interdisciplinary types of programs, particularly a thing called Life in Extreme Environments. You heard about the LTERs, the long-term ecological research that's being done earlier. One of the things NSF was accused of, appropriately I might add, is not having sustaining funding to have some long-term data collection and long-term real research results that go on. NSF tended to fund for short-term results and to flip from project to project to project. These sustaining funds are really, really helpful in order to move the needle in some really basic research areas and to get that research out into the public. So we support the sunsetting of ETIC and replacing it with the Oregon Talent Council, with the transfer of ETIC's sustaining funds to the HEC. House Bill 2728 would establish the Oregon Talent Council, which would oversee renewable funds of $15 million. And those renewable funds would be only for innovative programs and emergent needs. And it would broaden the investment portfolio, which is also critical here, to include healthcare, energy, and ag tech. And it would also open funding opportunities for all the colleges and universities in Oregon, which I think also is a really good idea when it's all said and done. And at this point, I will turn this over to David Children.
Thank you very much. Chairman Comp, Senator Moreau, members of the committee, my name is David Childers. I'm a resident of Lake Oswego. I'm here wearing a couple of different hats. I'm the Chair Emeritus of the Technology Association of Oregon, and I'm also an ETIC counselor. So I've been actively involved with a lot of business people looking at how ETIC transitions to the Oregon Talent Council. We've done a lot of work in terms of needs and portfolio. And in that portfolio, as Dr. Maple said, there's a number of areas where originally ETIC was created around high-tech needs. While we still see a huge need for engineering and a number of specialized talents, we're finding the competition for that is pretty great because many of those same jobs are needed in smart ag today. We're seeing healthcare and other emerging groups to where that we really have a strong need. In fact, when you look at the needs analysis that was published by the state, we have 132,000 unemployed people in the state of Oregon, and we have 45,000 open tech recs right now, and there's those people don't match in terms of that. So we're forced to really go outside the state to begin to fill those roles. So working with the Talent Council and trying to work to move forward, we certainly understand the needs to address those issues and to begin to use the work that ETIC has done in the past to work with the university systems to be able to support that. One of the bills that we're moving forward right now is House Bill 2996, which is the cybersecurity and the creation of the Center for Cybersecurity. OIT, Oregon State, Oregon, and PSU have already come together independently to work in support of being able to do more research, more grants, more abilities to work together in support of that. So the work that we've done is there's a lot of community and work moving toward that. The other side of it is that very honestly, we also recognize that while we don't hire high school students, I mean, we need qualified graduates. And one of the things that I'm excited about with the Oregon Talent Council as well is that there's a strong emphasis in involving our community colleges because there's a lot of work that can be done for our workforce within the community college level as well. But while we don't hire high school kids, we need to motivate them. And they need to see the value of the kinds of opportunities and the jobs that we have and the ability to bring that forward. So all of those things that you've heard today work together. That's why I will say that the Technology Association of Oregon and I personally very much in favor of the work and the bills that are in front of you today. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time and your coming to visit with us and give us this information. Okay. Dr. Adams, how are we doing?
We are done.
Okay, any final questions for this group of people?
Madam Co-Chair, full Ways and Means at 9 o'clock in the morning, and the next meeting of this group will be on Monday.
Monday, yes. So thank you. And Mr. Siebert, anything else? The only other thing that I would mention to our committee members is we received yesterday invitations for our community meetings. So when the Full Ways and Means Committee is in your community, it'd be great if you would attend and hear what your constituents have to say. And so, yes, please check your email for all those updates.
Okay. Madam Chair, just quickly. I would encourage the committee. I thought there might be more questions around ETIC and the transfer and the cyber proposal that are in. If they're very important initiatives, if anybody
if everybody understands them well, that's great. If you don't, I encourage you to get with folks and offline and get some answers to them, because we would like to see those move forward.
And that's in the Capital Construction Committee, or which committee?
I don't know where the particular bills are at this point.
So the cyber bill is with Representative Reed, Tobias okay. Reed, in terms of the work, and then the Oregon Talent Council has moved to Ways and Means from Representative Reed's council as well.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would imagine you would see the cybersecurity bill as well, because it has a $2.5 million general fund appropriation in it.
Thank you. And, yes, and Representative Huffman.
Rep Reed has been the point person, so he'd be a good resource also to answer any of these questions.
Okay, thank you. And I don't know if the members of the public know that basically today's the day if your bill's not being posted for a hearing. We're at a cycle where it needs to be posted, so make sure everything's in tune. And Senator Roblin, you have any advice for somebody that's trying to move a bill onto a schedule at the last minute?
I would say that knowing the number of bills we had this session, there's not a lot of room. So good luck.
Okay. With that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 5024, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
We do have full Ways Means to
Thank you.
We do have full Ways Means to
And we are adjourned.